So, last week we've discussed locks, or like lock-free and wait-free algorithms and locks, and this week I'll continue with this. And we were somewhere on page 20, and I will get there. So, who can tell me the difference between a mutex and a monitor?
Monitor is re-entrant, which means that if the same thread or process tries to enter the lock one more time, it will.
Yes. So there it is. A monitor is a mutex that is re-entrant. And here we come. Oh. Well, I went through the process of... let's see. It might be. Okay. So, let's start with where we left off last week. So, I told you how to implement a monitor. And... there is a deschedule down here. I've in the slides that I've uploaded earlier today, I've tried to fix the deschedule problem, not by changing anything about the deschedule. I just changed the specification to make you unhappy. So now deschedule, basically, it enters the operating system, and it doesn't wait for a write action. It just waits until the variable doesn't contain anything except zero, and then it will return. And it might do so by monitoring writes on that memory location. Okay, so an example for monitors is if I take this push left method and I remove all the locking and I simply have a monitor enter at the beginning and a monitor leave at the end, and I assume that there's no internal return. Everything, every return from the function will execute monitor leave. Then I can implement the for all method, a method that just takes a callback function that supplied some auxiliary data and the queue and applies the callback function to all elements in that double-ended queue. I can implement this function by also wrapping it into a monitor. And by doing that, I can pass for all a function that itself uses the same monitor. So, for instance, I can pass it push left. So, for instance, I can say for all QQ, the address of push left, and that will then duplicate all the entries in the queue, and it won't block, because if I say monitor enter here, the same monitor is being held, and that's okay because it's the same monitor and it's re-entrant. So, using a monitor instead of a mutex ensures that this recursive it's not a recursive call, but it's a recursive call to the monitor, so to say. It doesn't block. So we fixed two things. We set out to fix certain deficiencies of the semaphore, the mutex implementation. There's still one thing open. So there's this efficiency problem when I'm using this double-ended queue as a resource to synchronize. So, for instance, if a thread T waits for a data structure to be filled, like a doubly linked list, then the T will call pop write, and if it's empty, pop write will just return minus one. And then T basically has no chance because it just needs something to work with, so it just has to call pop write again until an element is available. So that's kind of busy waiting because there's no other chance of observing or waiting until the data structure is non-empty. So T is busy waiting, and it also produces contention on the lock inside the monitor, so we want to avoid that. So the idea is then to create a condition variable, which is the modern name for this concept, and I'll say a little bit about the history later. And so we take our data structure monitor, and we extend it by one new field called cond for condition. And the idea of this condition variable is that it's similar to some sort of like semaphore that says whether some condition holds or not. And there's two functions. There's a wait function that waits for a condition to become true. And the idea is that the user calls this function inside while being inside the monitor. So you enter the monitor, you check whether some condition on your data structure is true or not. If that condition needs to be true and it's not, then you say wait on the condition variable. This has the effect of temporarily releasing the monitor. So that thread is in the monitor. It calls wait on the condition. That releases the monitor. And then this thread will go to sleep. And later on, a different thread can enter the monitor, do something so the condition becomes true, and that thread will then do a signal on this condition variable, and the other thread wakes up. So there's an orthogonal function called signal on the condition variable, which signals that the thread waiting on the condition variable may proceed now. And the semantics is that either one or all threads that are waiting on the condition variable will be woken up. And then there's two possibilities, two different semantics that can be implemented. And the one is called signal and urgent wait, and the other is called signal and continue. So the question is, what happens if the second thread enters the monitor and it says, I've changed something, and I'm saying the condition that other threads waited for is now true? So what should happen? Should this current thread inside the monitor, should that be suspended and let the other threads proceed? Or should this thread go to the end and do its normal thing until it leaves the monitor, and only then should the other threads be allowed to enter the monitor? So there are these two options. And the first, signal and urgent wait, is the first option. So that means, again, the signaling thread, that means the second thread that entered the monitor that calls signal, is suspended immediately. And the execution continues with one of the signal threads that now can now proceed because the condition has become true. The second semantics is that the signaling thread, so the second thread that to enter the monitor, it simply continues until it naturally releases the monitor, and only once it has released the monitor, the signal threads, one or all of them, can enter the monitor. So only once the monitor is released or becomes available. Okay, and there's some very nice pictures on Wikipedia, which I copied, which illustrate this. So first of all, the signal and urgent wait semantics. So I have a thread, which is red, and that enters the monitor. So it tries to acquire the monitor, and if somebody is inside the monitor, so this is the critical section, the living room, and in the antechamber is the queue where the thread is waiting. So if the monitor is occupied, it will wait here, so E is a queue. Every room is kind of a queue. But it will eventually proceed to be in the living room, so it enters the critical section, and now it realizes there's some precondition, some condition is not satisfied. So for instance, the doubly linked list is empty, and it needs to be non-empty. And then it calls wait on, say, condition A. So A is a condition variable, B is a different condition variable. What it then does, it calls wait, and it enters into this chamber, and that's the waiting queue for A. So now we have the red thread waiting. In the antechamber. Now a second thread enters, so the blue one is in the critical section, and it does something to make the condition true. So for instance, it adds an element to the doubly ended list, and it calls signal. And we have in the signal and urgent wait semantics, that means that this thread enters a queue for all those threads that have signaled and cannot continue until the signal threads have executed. So now the second thread is in the S queue. So once the blue thread is here, the red thread can now proceed from the A queue, which because it has been signaled and it can enter back into the critical section, can do its thing, and then it leaves eventually by calling monitor exit. In case the chamber of A is empty and S, the blue thread that waits here in the S queue can enter immediately. It will also enter once the thread A leaves down here. It will just enter again and then continue. And in case this chamber and this chamber is empty, the last thread to leave here will obviously, if there's a thread in here, then the next thread can enter as usual. Okay, so that's the signal and urgent wait semantics. The second thread that enters and where the first thread has called wait, if it says signal, the other thread that has been suspended will continue and the current thread is suspended. So in particular, there's two queues here waiting to enter, and then obviously S, the ones that have been suspended after they've been once in the monitor, they have priority over the ones that have never been so far in the monitor. Okay, so the second, yeah?
Why is the B queue
useful? The B queue, well, you can have more than one condition variable, and so this just is a picture for two condition variables, A and B. So I'm only going to talk about one condition variable, and I'll motivate that in a second. Okay, the second is the signal and continue semantics. So again, we have the first thread entering and possibly waiting on the QE if the monitor is taken currently. But suppose it is not taken and we enter the critical section, then we're in here. And we realize, oh, there is the condition that we need, and it's not fulfilled, and we say we wait on the A condition variable. So we enter this chamber here, and we're being suspended. Okay, so now we're in the A chamber with A. So we have one person waiting here, one thread waiting there. The second thread enters, is in the critical section, and then realizes it has done something that makes the condition variable true. So it calls signal on the condition variable A, which means that A can now proceed. So it calls, the blue thread calls notify on A, and then one thread from the A queue is moved to the E queue. So it's back in the antechamber, unless A is empty. And in this case, nothing happens until, so there's the red thread in here, nothing happens until the blue thread that's still in the critical section actually leaves. Only if it leaves, a thread from the EQ will be woken up. And one thread that is in the EQ is the red thread. So here the red thread can now enter the critical section again after the blue thread has left the whole apartment, the critical section. Now, obviously, there might be some other threads in here that have entered the critical, the antechamber that want to enter the monitor. And then the question is, well, in which sequence will this happen? So if I first have the blue thread, then the green thread, then the yellow thread entering, and then the blue thread calls signal, then the A thread will be woken up, and it's probably going to be put into the queue after the green and the yellow thread. So other threads might be first to, for instance, pick out the element from the doubly linked list. So A might actually have to be suspended again if it was waiting for that. So assuming that this is first in, first out, the queue to enter E, then threads, as I said, threads trying to that try to enter the monitor between the wait of the first thread and the notify of the second thread, they will run before the red thread, the first thread. So it's not really that fair. If we want to have fairness, that is, like, if we want to give priority over threads that have been that have called wait, then we need a second queue somewhere in here, and then we have to move them over here and then give priority to threads in this chamber over threads in here, which was similar to the last slide. Okay, So the signal and continuous semantics is attractive because it's much simpler to implement. So for instance, if we don't implement this SQ.
And also, isn't it possible to simulate the first thing, this urgent thing, with a signal and continuous stuff?
You can implement everything with everything. I think that is... the question is, with how much infrastructure do you need?
I mean...
These are three queues for two condition variables, which means you can create three mutexes and then use locks to protect these, like to implement these mutexes, and then you can implement your signal and urgent wait and signal and continuous semantics monitors. And then you can implement every mutex with a monitor again, so you can implement the signal and urgent wait with at most three signal and continue monitors by not using any condition variables. So, yes, you're right, but it's not helping. I mean, in a sense, it's not making it easier. Okay. We implement a simpler signal and continue semantics because I couldn't be bothered with this complex signal and urgent wait semantics. And also because it's not very common in languages. So the notified, that means the notified thread is simply woken up and competes for the monitor in the EQ with all the other threads that want to enter the monitor. So first of all, I have to implement two functions, the condition wait, I call them, and condition notify. If I call condition wait, I should be in the monitor, so the thread ID of the monitor should be my ID, meaning I'm occupying the monitor. Then there is a count for the recursive entering of the monitor. I make a backup of this count because I'm going to allow other threads to enter the monitor in a second. So I allow other threads to enter the monitor in by setting the ID to zero, because that's what the other threads always test, is the thread ID of the monitor zero. That means it's not occupied, so I set it to my thread ID and thereby acquiring it. Then I'm using a binary semaphore and call mWait on the condition variable, which means I'm going to be suspended. So this is the AQ in the last picture, or the BQ, depending, which means I'm going to be suspended if the condition does not hold. If the condition holds, initially somebody should have set signal on the semaphore to start off with. Okay, and then I have this typical lock code the code that we've at least seen earlier. So this Boolean variable next to enter, and the question is, I am the next to enter if the thread ID is zero. And if I'm the next to enter, then I set the thread ID to my own ID, I restore my old counter, and thereby I have acquired the free monitor, and I've now acquired it, and now it's mine. And then if I haven't succeeded, I will just call deschedule for performance, like for avoiding busy waiting, so the operating system will put me in a queue and suspend the whole thread until it waits until the thread ID becomes empty, and it does that. It may use some mechanism that checks, that intercepts writes to empty ID to this address. So I do this until next to enter is true, so until I have succeeded in entering the monitor. And the notify couldn't be simpler. It's simply implemented by calling signal on the binary semaphore. So that way, a condition variable is just a semaphore. Okay, so then because the semantics is kind of fuzzy, as soon as I say notify, the thread suspended on the condition variable will enter the QE in the entrance, in the antechamber, and then it competes with all the other threads. If it's that unstructured and there's no priorities anyway, I might be even more general and implement two notify functions, one that wakes up exactly one thread and puts it into the antechamber so it can compete with other threads, and it might also be useful to have a notify all that takes all the threads that wait on a condition variable and puts them all into the antechamber. Then maybe that's actually useful in case say there is a thread that, in the example of the linked list, if I have lots of threads that extract a single element, and if a thread can enter more than one element, then the condition will remain true for several times, and then I might as well say notify all, and then they will be put into the queue and might be even fairer. Who knows? But like in practice, there's no real fairness guarantee. And then in practice, it's even easier if notify means notify some. And I'll say something about Java, and there's a function called notify, and I think it doesn't even have the guarantee that you're only notifying one thread, but at least one thread. Yes. Well, that's an additional question. So is the condition variable organized, like the waiting on the condition variable, is that organized as a queue? But really, I think in normal programming, if you cannot, since woken up, threads woken up that were waiting on the condition variable, if they compete for the monitor with all the other threads, then I think there's not much probably to be gained by having a queue for the condition variable, and then this rather random mix of threads entering the monitor in the antechamber, so to say.
So the notify wakes up a random thread, and I cannot specify which one?
No, I don't think you can ever specify which one, because that's... Well, if you want to notify some thread specifically, you probably set up a condition variable with you and the thread as a condition variable that's exclusive to you and the other thread. That's the way to do that. Because this is mostly about, if you want to communicate with several threads, then usually you want to have a mechanism to coordinate several threads. If you just have two threads, you might as well use a semaphore. Which also has a monitor, like which has a queue, so you could also coordinate several threads. But yeah, I don't know whether it's an application that where you specifically want to like randomly pick out one from the, or like specifically by characterizing something, picking out a single element from the queue. I'm not sure. I don't think so. Okay, so yeah, so your question was the priority of the notified threads. So the first sentence doesn't really make sense in this context. It just says that in this implementation that I've given you, it's a bit weird that like as soon as you wake in the signal and continue semantics, the second thread, the blue thread entering, doing a signal means that the other thread will be woken up and it will suspend immediately because the monitor is still occupied. So it's a bit inefficient. Because in the end, they all compete for the same monitor and the monitor is still occupied by the blue thread currently and then maybe by other threads. And, well, I said this earlier, if the OS implements FIFO order on the monitor queue, the E queue, then the notified threads will run after the threads that have tried to enter since the thread called wait. And you can implement this extra queue if you want to have proper priority, and I'm not dealing with that. Okay, so let's see how we can implement the doubly ended queue with monitors. So we had a semaphore here earlier. Okay, sorry. The monitor is now in QM, so the DQ data structure Q contains the monitor M and the condition variable C. So I'm saying Q arrow M for the monitor, Q arrow C for the condition variable. So I define pop write now as follows. I say monitor enter on QM, the monitor of the W ended Q. And then I do my setup where I try to remove an element from the rightmost element. So I have the sentinel node here, and possibly a node that is not the last one inside, like sitting in between the left sentinel and the right sentinel node. So I'm going to the right, that's my right sentinel, I'm going to the right, that's my right sentinel. Then the old right node that I want to remove is the one that, that's to the left of the right sentinel. And then if the old right node, this one, is equal to the left sentinel, then the queue is empty. And I'm calling wait on the condition variable, and I'm going to L to check again after I'm being woken up whether I'm now the right sentinel, the node that is to the left of the right sentinel is the left sentinel. So I'll do this in a loop. So even if I do a notify all, this will suspend myself again correctly if the list doesn't have at least one node in it. And then I do the what I've done before. So this is the old right node, looking at the node that's to the left of the old right node, which could be the left sentinel. And then of that node, I'm setting the right pointer to the left right sentinel, and the right sentinel pointer, the left pointer of that, I'm setting to this node that's to the left of the old right node. And then I'm leaving the monitor because I now have a pointer to the old right node, and the old right node value is what I'm interested in, and I'm freeing the old right node and return the value. So as you can see, there are some things that I can do outside the monitor, as before with the locks, and instead of releasing the lock and returning, I can now suspend and try again once I'm not unsuspended. Yeah, so because I'm constructing a loop here by this fabulous goto, it's okay that I'm being woken up several times, even if the condition goes to false again. Okay, so this topic, can we implement one with the other? Yes, so a monitor can be implemented using semaphores semaphores, because we also want to implement the condition variables. So each queue we can protect with a mutex, and we can use a binary semaphore to implement the condition variables. So the thing is, it needs to be a binary semaphore with the semantics that if I do several signals in a row, the condition variable remains true, because I could have several threads that call signal. And it usually just means that the condition is true, it remains true, it doesn't become more than true. So you could use counting. So for instance, you could use a counting semaphore to track how many elements are in the doubly ended queue. And by that, a thread that wants to remove one element would try to wait on the counting semaphore. If that decreases to zero, meaning there's no more element in the queue, then it will be suspended. And if another thread enters to add nodes, and it adds, say, 20 nodes, it could call signal 20 times, or with an argument of 20, and increment the counter, the semaphore, by 20 elements. And then it could then, if everything is exact, then you could then exactly 20 threads that remove one element would be woken up. But like what you have in pthreads, the condition variables are just binary semaphores. So can a semaphore be implemented using a monitor? Of course. I mean, the monitor is more general. The only thing, so if we have a semaphore variable S and we want to implement it with a monitor, then we need to make sure that we don't allow recursive calls. So what we could do, if we implement signal wait, we could check the value of S, and if it is zero, that means if it's taken, we could wait on a condition variable and then thereby block. So I'm not going into the details here. So note on the history, I said the condition variable is the modern name. Back in the days, condition variables were meant to be associated with a predicate. So the idea is you have a data structure and there is some property that can be expressed as a predicate. So the predicate could be a piece of code that evaluate something on the data structure. For instance, it could check whether the left and the right sentinel are next to each other, and that means that the queue, the W-ended queue, is empty. And then the idea was originally that signaling on a condition variable will only wake up one thread if the condition, the semantics of this code, returns true. So if you want to implement general conditions and have the operating system handle that, that's a bit difficult because the operating system would have to determine whether this predicate P holds. So it would have to run the code that computes P, and that would have to be done atomically, which is a bit tricky even for the operating system because it would have to coordinate with all the other threads that are running. If P implements arbitrary code, then that's the problem for the operating system anyway because that just means scheduling the thread again and waiting for it to return eventually. And what is the semantics if it doesn't return in a timely fashion? So the idea is simple, or the consequence is simple. Basically, you wake up the thread and have the thread check the property or the predicate it wants to implement itself. So you just wake it up and then... So the thread waiting on the condition variable is woken up. It is put into the queue competing to enter the monitor. And once inside the monitor, it will evaluate the predicate. Thereby, the predicate will be evaluated in mutual exclusion, so automaticity is not a problem. And then if the predicate holds, it can continue as it would have done in the first run, or it will be suspended again if the predicate does not hold, as it did in the last run. So what we can then do is if we have identified, say, set of predicates that are interesting, we can create a condition variable for each set of threads with the same predicate. So you could have several threads that enter a monitor, and then some of these threads might be interested in some property, and for each property, some of the threads are interested, and you create a condition variable that tests this property P. And you notify if this predicate may have changed. It might not have changed, but each time it could have turned true, you need to call notify. And you could also notify all the threads each time any of the predicates change. So if you could do that, then one possibility, the universal possibility, is that you just allow exactly one condition variable per monitor and that predicate, like, and then you just wake up anybody who's waiting on a condition variable, and then they check whatever they want to check, and then go back to sleep if what they're interested in is not fulfilled. So rather than having like a whole set of predicates, you could just have a single condition variable, and that suffices in principle to do all this waiting for all threads. So monitors with single condition variables are a special case and very easy to implement because then, well, it's just clear cut what is there, what condition variables are here. And so, for instance, they're implemented in Java and C#. And so if you've come across the synchronized keyword in Java, synchronized just means you call monitor enter when you enter the method, and you call monitor leave when you leave the method. And the monitor is implemented inside the base class object. So every Java object has a monitor associated with it. So down in the object base class, it has this monitor variable, it has the count variable, and it has one condition variable, and the two functions monitor enter, monitor leave. So you don't see these normally, and they might have different names, but that's the principle. So when you say synchronize, the compiler silently translates that by turning the synchronize keyword into monitor enter, monitor leave. And monitor enter, monitor leave will work on these private variables in the object base class. So then you have this picture with one condition variable. So if you call... So you have one condition variable. So if you call wait on an object, it goes in here. And if the blue object comes along and then it calls notify or notify all, and one or at least one or all of them will be put back into the antechamber. That's the semantics of Java. One condition variable and one monitor whenever you want it by adding synchronized. Does somebody know how to write a Java program that uses a different monitor, not the monitor of the current object? So suppose you have five objects and they share one resource, and but this resource is kind of spread across the five objects, then what you really want is one monitor that all these objects, whenever they do anything, have to acquire before they do something. Because if you make all these functions synchronized, you might get a deadlock, which I'll show in a minute. Has anybody used synchronized yet? Has anybody used synchronized with some optional argument? No. Ah, well. Well done. So what you can do, correct me if I'm wrong. I hope the syntax is right. I think there's round parentheses here, and you can specify it some sort of other object. And if you say, no?
Oh, I don't know it like this. I only know it that you just write public void without synchronized, and then inside the block, function block, you write again synchronized, other parameter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Maybe I've got that wrong. So it's syn. So instead of this, you say synchronized. Oh, this is bad. Synchronized. Well, you can guess the rest. Nized. And then say this other object is O. And then squiggly parenthesis open, squiggly parenthesis both, close. And then the body, whatever you want to have inside a monitor, you put into this parenthesis in the body. And that means just acquire the monitor on entering this block of statements and release it when you're done with this block of statements. And that way you can just use a different object as a monitor. So in principle, you can just like create, you can say new object and use that as a monitor wherever you need one by supplying it here as O. Okay. So now we enter the land of deadlocks. So locks seem to be a universal concept and easy enough, which is, well, the devil is in the details. And one details are deadlocks. So what is a deadlock? So a deadlock is a situation in which two processes are waiting for the respective other to finish, and thus neither process ever does finish. And this definition generalizes to a set of processes that have a cyclic dependency. And obviously, if a program runs into this situation, the program will not progress and all the threads involved in the deadlock will block forever. Usually, other threads will wait on these blocked threads and the whole program will become unresponsive, which often is considered a bad thing. Well, actually, it's hard to imagine when it's not considered a bad thing. So, here's an example. This is Java, I hope. So, this is a foo class, and it has a sister class called other, and it's initially null. And it has a synchronized function called bar. And depending on some random condition, it calls bar on the other sister class. Now, if I'm creating two instances called A and B, both are foo, and then I'm saying the sister class of A is B and the sister class of B is A, then I have this nice pair of classes and one refers to the other. And then I'm running in parallel A.bar and B.bar. What happens then, what can happen then, is that thread A and thread B execute A.bar and B.bar by themselves, any order. And then A.bar decides to acquire the monitor. Well, it will acquire the monitor of A because bar is a synchronized method. And then B will acquire the monitor of B because it is a synchronized method. So both hold their own monitors. Now, A happens to find this condition to be true and executes other.bar, which means it calls bar on the B class. It blocks because the monitor of the B class is being held by none other than B. And then B happens to just execute other.bar, and other.bar is A.bar. And then A.bar is currently held by the class A itself. And then they both block indefinitely, and this is a deadlock. Okay, that's bad. How can we avoid this situation? So what is a formal definition? Well, no, the other way around. So when do deadlocks occur? A deadlock can only occur if and only if we have the four conditions holding. We need all four of them. So these were defined in 1971, so they did have concurrency back then, amazingly. So you have to have mutual exclusion. That means you have to have a data structure that ensures that only one process can be inside that critical section or hold, acquire the data structure, so semaphore or monitor. Then we have to have a wait for property, which means that a process holds a resource, so one of these mutually exclusive data structures, and it wants another one. So it is in a position of a resource and it is waiting for more. Then if we have this and we could take resources away, then we could like resolve these problems. But in case we cannot, we have no preemption, we cannot take resources away that are being held by some threats, then we can enter a deadlock. And so once we have then the circular wait for condition in our program, no preemption, and then we have a cycle of processes that indefinitely wait, and then we have a deadlock. So what can we do about deadlocks? The very popular one is the first one, we ignore them. That means we just ignore the fact that they can happen, which is the approach taken in most desktop operating systems. So this is actually quite reasonable because deadlocks are relatively rare. Well, I mean, sometimes Windows hangs, sometimes Linux hangs, but it's not very often.
I remember a Windows software which had a resolve deadlocks button. And if it hangs, then you could click it and then it would, I don't know, maybe kill all the threads or something. And
it's called Alt Control Delete or. Yeah.
The software continues to run, but I don't know what threat it kills.
Well, I mean, yeah. So that's called preemption. I'm amazed. Okay. So how can we resolve, like how can we deal with deadlocks? If we have detection, in principle the OS has all these threads, the queues, and it knows which threads are waiting for what. And it could then check in these queues for a cycle. And if it does detect the deadlock, and then it's not quite done because it needs to resolve the deadlock. So if it then on top of that can take a resource like a mutex away from a certain process, that means it has the ability to preempt, then it can actually resolve the deadlock situation. Problem is here that preemption is very difficult because usually when you're inside a mutual exclusion, inside a mutex, then you have already computed something and you'd have to like undo that or have some other way to exit. It depends. I mean, you can write an operating system where you call monitor enter, and you block, and then it gives you a return value saying, well, I can't give you the resource, but you have to release all the other monitors you're holding as well, which are these. And then you can implement that by hand, which would be very difficult, but that's imaginable. There's no reason why you couldn't do that. Prevention is a very good thing, in principle. So you could just design your programs to be deadlock-free. If there's no cycles, then there will never be a deadlock. And then there's the fourth ability, which is that used to be a very hot research topic like 20 or something years ago. Avoidance. So the operating system monitors which threads want to acquire which semaphores. And if you could just see that this might lead to a deadlock, although it hasn't deadlocked yet, then you could just suspend this thread and not let it acquire a certain semaphore, for instance. So you could stop the circle from being built before it happens. However, that needs additional information about the program. So, for instance, if you need all what I'll introduce as lock sets, if you knew all the lock sets of a program, then maybe you can compute from that a scheduling so that deadlocks can never occur. So this is involves a lot of interaction between applications and operating systems. So this is not very viable, really, in practice. So on standard operating systems, including mobile phones, prevention is probably the best thing to do because it's an application side only solution. It doesn't involve the operating system. We can immediately get deadlock freedom by using lock-free algorithms, because if we don't have locks, we don't have mutual exclusion, and there we go. Obviously, there's data structures that are too complex to implement a lock-free algorithm for. And so we have to use locking, for instance. Okay, so how can we write applications that never have a deadlock? So one observation is that we need to have a cycle in as one of the four conditions between our processes, a cycle of wait for properties or relations. So a cycle cannot occur if we can partially order the locks in the sense that the wait for relation is a partial order and can never form a cycle. So in order to do that, or to check that, I define lock sets that define this wait for relation, or that we use to define this wait for relation. So I suppose that I have a set of lock instances. So if you think of Java, it's not the objects, but it's an instance of an object, because if I have two instances of an object, I have two different monitors. As you've seen in the foo class, I had just one object, I create two instances, I have two monitors, and then I can have a deadlock. So I have to look at each instance individually. So let's let L be the set of lock or lock instances. So we call lambda of P, which is a subset of L, the lock set of program point P. That is a set of locks that may be acquired in the acquired state at program point P. So if I have the doubly ended Q and I'm inside the critical section and my lock is called M for the monitor in the, or Q arrow M, and Q arrow M is one element in lambda P. Totally independently, I define a transitive closure operation. So if I have some sort of relation sigma, which is a subset of tuples of X, then I define the transitive closure as written sigma plus as the union of sigma I, where sigma 0 is just sigma, and sigma I plus 1 are all the tuples X1, X3, such there exists a third element X2, such that X1, X2 is in sigma I, so I'm defining I plus 1, and that X2, X3 is in sigma I. So that means if I have a B, C, D, and I have E, and I have a relation here, an arrow here, say, and an arrow here, and an arrow here, then and an arrow here. Then if this is my sigma, then sigma 1 will take, for instance, this arrow and this arrow. So this is X1, this is X2, this is X3, and then at this arrow. And also the arrow B to C, C to D, sigma 1 would contain this arrow, and the arrow from C to D, D to E, X1, X2, X3, sigma 1 would add this arrow. And now given sigma 1, I can compute sigma 2, which would then compute the same thing as sigma 1, but in addition it will take the blue arrows. So it will take this blue arrow and combine it with this edge, x1, x2, x3, and add this edge. And for B, it will add the red, combine the red arrow with the blue arrow and will get me there. Okay? Eventually, I'll get a fixed point, which is the transitive closure of the red arrow relation. Okay, so how can I use this transitive closure? Well, so the lock set just tells me which locks are held at a particular program point. So I'm now defining a relation triangle, which is a relation between locks, such that a lock instance L is less than L prime if L is currently held at that program point, and the statement at P, at the program point P, is either wait L prime or monitor enter L prime. So that means I want the delta, or the triangular relation, to be defined in a way that if I'm acquiring a lock L prime and I'm currently holding a lock L, then L must be less than L prime. Okay, so all the locks I'm newly acquiring will be greater, have to be greater than the locks I'm already holding. And then I'm taking the triangle and make that a bit rounder, and I say that this less than relation is the transitive closure of my triangle. So because the triangle itself just tells me occasionally here and there that there is a relation between two locks, and if I take the transitive closure, I get the relation between all locks transitively. Now, I haven't said this is an order. I'm saying less than, but this is just like intuitive because it might not be an order. So that becomes clear if I say what a deadlock is. So if the freedom of a deadlock, meaning the absence of a deadlock, is the following. So if I have mutexes and monitors, then if there is no A in L, where A is less than A itself, that means if I'm taking a lock A, and in the lock set there's not currently a lock A, and if this is also true in the transitive closure, then the program is free of deadlocks. So obviously, if I'm trying to acquire a lock and the lock is already taken by me or by somebody else, then I will deadlock. And so this is just saying, okay, I take this relation, this triangle relation, to the transitive closure, and if that closure does not contain self-cycles, or a transitive cycle even, then it's lock-free. So note, if I had a cycle with several locks, something more complex, then if I do the transitive closure, I will add this arc, and I will add this arc in the second step, and then I will add this arc, and in the third iteration, I'll take this blue arc and this red arc, so I will add this arc, I will add this arc, and I will add this arc. And now you can imagine that taking the transitive closure, if there is a cycle, will create a self-cycle. And so this theorem says, if inside the transitive closure of the lock set relationship, or holds a lock, the lambda relationship, the triangle, if there is no self-cycle, then I can be sure that I don't have any cyclic wait for condition. Okay, so we said monitors can be recursive, as in a monitor. If I'm holding a monitor, I can enter the monitor again. So I should say something better for monitors, because naturally, a monitor, if I'm entering a monitor twice, then I have a self cycle, and that kind of like spoils the fun if I reject all of that. Suppose our program blocks on semaphores, so it creates mutexes. And I call these instances are called LS for semaphore, and on monitors LM, then I want to treat LM differently. So my overall set of lock instances is LS and LM, and this is a disjoint union. because I can't mix those. My monitor stays a monitor, cannot be used as a semaphore. Okay, so now the new theory, freedom for of deadlocks for monitors and semaphores. So if I look at the semaphores, so for all semaphores, a semaphore may not have a self-cycle. Okay, first thing for semaphores. Now for monitors, if I have two lock instances, and one of them has to be a monitor, and I have a self-cycle between these, so A is less than B and B is less than A, then they have to be the same. If this is the case, then B is a monitor as well. That means I have a self-cycle between monitors. So if my less than, well, my this one, this relation, if it contains no self-cycles for semaphores and only self-cycles, direct self-cycles for monitors. Did I say monitors earlier? No self-cycles for semaphores and only self-cycles for monitors, then it is still deadlock-free. Okay, as I said before, L is the instance, are instances of semaphores and locks, semaphores and monitors. Not, say, an object in Java which implements a monitor of which I can create several instances. So the problem now is that the set of lock instances can actually vary at runtime and it's not fixed. So if in Java you can create new objects, and so it's never, the set of monitors is thereby never fixed. So if we want to statically ensure that deadlocks cannot occur, we have to do further approximations. So we have to summarize, for instance, this is one possibility, we could summarize every lock monitor that may have several instances into one. So we take the syntactic constructs in the program, so in Java we could just take objects that we've declared and say, okay, all monitors that are created from this object we summarize into one. So let's call these summarized locks monitors a bar. So this is kind of like a putting together several lock and monitor instances into one lock or monitor instance. And I call this A bar. So it represents several instances, several concrete locks. Now the problem is, if I test whether A bar is less than A bar, then since A bar represents a set of locks, I cannot be sure which specific instances that I've summarized here I'm talking about. So if I have a self-cycle between A bar and A bar being a summary of several locks, I don't know, is this a self-cycle? Is this a cycle between the same representative of A bar and the same representative of A bar? Or is this not a self-cycle, which is the case if there's one representative in A bar that has a cycle with a different representative also in A bar? So the only thing we can then do, if we still want to maintain our checks or theorems here, then we have to require that there's no self-cycles between any two summarized locks A bar, which means that the special treatment, the more precise treatment for monitors, we cannot do anymore, because as soon as we summarize monitors into a summary monitor A bar and we have a self-cycle, we don't know whether it's a self-instance of the monitor or a different instance of the monitor. If it's a different instance of a monitor, for example, in the example of the foo class, it is a monitor, and they wait for each other, and they deadlock. Okay, so to summarize, how can we verify that programs contain no deadlocks? Well, we identify mutexes protected by semaphores, call these instances log S, and we summarize them, so then our instances, they're kind of like constructs in the program, and then we create, and we have summarized monitor locks, and I call these LMS because I treat it differently. And then maybe there are some monitors where each instance corresponds exactly to the program object. So if I only ever create one instance of a certain Java class, then I could just then I treat this specially, because then I can allow recursive taking of this log because it's not, I know it's exactly one. So I single out the non-summarized monitors. So here, an object in the program corresponds to one instance. So LMN for non-summarized is the difference between all monitors and the summarized ones. And now we take this less than relationship and check that it's a partial order, and then the transitive closure gives us a total order. No, that's rubbish. The transitive, we can create a total order from the transitive closure of this partial order. So, but once we have this log order, we can check that no cycles exist except for self cycles for non-summary monitors. And if that is the case, we know there is a way to, we know that our program is deadlock free. So we kind of won. Now the problem is, what do we do when this log order contains a cycle? Well, in principle, this doesn't mean that the program will deadlock or can deadlock, because what we've done here, especially with summarizing, it's an approximation of the truth. And I'll show you on the next slide that why this whole log set thing is an approximation anyway. So first of all, determining which logs could be acquired at a given program position is an undecidable property, because it's the same as asking, is the program halting? So the halting problem is undecidable. So what I've done here is obviously an approximation, that if the approximation says your program is deadlock free, your program is deadlock free. If your approximation says, I don't know whether you, like your deadlock freedom is not guaranteed, then it's not clear whether the program is deadlock free. It could be deadlock free still. So, for instance, one common problem is an array of logs or an array of monitors. If you only have a single array that you're using to store instances of a certain monitor, and all the instances are in this array, then you could ensure that you always log these monitors in increasing, with smaller indices first before you log larger indices. And that way, you still have a linear log order. So you could think of this as, instead of summarizing the whole array into a single summary element A prime, you symbolically represent the array elements as AI, and you require that AI's is a log, the log order of AI is less than AI plus one. So you always acquire logs in earlier indices before logs in later indices. And, okay, so this is for arrays. If you simply have a program point, so you have a cycle, and you identify one program point where a log L is being held, and you want to acquire a new log L prime, this program point, in this program point, L prime is already acquired. If you want to acquire L prime and it's not in the original triangle order, but it's in the transitive closure, then somewhere else there is a point in the program where L prime has been already in the log set and somebody acquired L prime. But locally here, it's not the case. So what we can do is we could release L just to satisfy the order. We could release L, acquire L prime, and then acquire L again. So we don't create this edge between L and L prime. Now this is a bit tricky. This might not work. So usually that means you have one critical section protected by L, and afterwards inside there you need a critical section that is protected by L prime. And now I'm suggesting what you can do is you can release L here, then acquire L prime, and then acquire L again. But that obviously means somebody can butt in here at the blue arrow and change something that is an invariant that's protected by L. So this solution might not work in practice. And moreover, if we use these summarized log sets A bar, and we need to acquire, sorry, if a log set lambda at a program point contains L, the summarized log L A bar, and we need to acquire something that corresponds to A bar, then we're stuck. There's no easy way to fix that. And an example for the latter is the foo class that actually does contain a deadlock, because the foo class is we have this one object, and we summarize all the monitors of that object in a single summarized log A bar, and the two instances actually do deadlock, and so this is a case where the summarization actually has not lost the information. There is actually deadlock. Okay. So, let's fix the algorithm. Oh no, let's check the algorithm. Maybe we don't have to fix it. So we now want to have some sort of concurrent removal. So recall we had this doubly-ended queue with the left sentinel and the right sentinel. Those are nodes that are always fixed, right sentinel. And in between here, we had one or zero or more nodes. So what we had earlier is we had a weight here and a signal down here. But the thing is that, so this is the pop right, so this is the one that goes down here. And there's a special case in here where, okay, so we lock the right sentinel node more or less because we need to modify this part here. Earlier today I said, oh, here we look at the right sentinel, and this is the old right node here, old right node. And then we check whether the old right node is equal to the left sentinel, and then we can't extract a node. And then if there is a node, then normally we just like extract the node, return it, and we patch up the node that's to the left of this node. Now we can do something more. We can check whether the new right node, which will be somewhere here, make that green dotted because it might be anywhere. So the new right node is the node that is to the left of the old right node here. And then the new right node might be equal to the left sentinel. If that is the case, then we're extracting the last element from the doubly linked list. Now the idea is, if there is at least two elements in the doubly linked list, it would be, less efficient to block the whole doubly linked list because we can extract one element without interfering with the other process that can only add elements to the left. So if we have at least two elements, we can always extract the leftmost element without interfering with the other process that adds new node to the left because it's only adding nodes. So what we do is we create a second log. So here we have log T and here we have log S. So if the new right node, the green one, is the left sentinel, then we block, acquire the right to mess with the left sentinel. So the new right node is the left sentinel node, and then we set the right pointer of the left sentinel node to the right sentinel node. This is what we would have done on the green node anyway. And the right sentinel node, the left pointer, points to the new right node. So in this case, here, this is equal to the left sentinel node. And if this condition was true, then we release this semaphore again. Now, the thing is that the implementation of the push left function only blocks or only acquires the mutex QS. So it locks a different mutex than we normally do, and only if the queue is so empty that we could interfere with the process that inserts nodes, we will acquire the right to modify the left sentinel. So if the queue contains all the time at least two elements, these two processes, the one that inserts nodes and the one that extracts nodes, they will never interfere, they will never block each other. So it could be, in principle, much more efficient. Okay, so here we wait, and here we release, and then here we release the mutex that protected the right hand, the right sentinel. We extract the value, free the node as before. Other questions? I think this is an exercise to implement this. Maybe not on this sheet. Well, no, it should be then next week, right? Yeah, I think it might be. If not, we can turn it into one. So, I mean, there's nothing difficult to implement. You just like probably have to run it and see that it doesn't crash, and maybe then you remove these two and see that it crashes. Okay, so let's look at whether this process is deadlock-free. So now we have two locks, so it's a bit more interesting than one lock, because with one lock it's very difficult to get a cycle. Unless, because it's a monitor, like, if it's a monitor, then it's totally uninteresting. If it's a semaphore, if it's a mutex, yes, it would be interesting. But here, at least we have two locks, so it could be very interesting. So let's look at the structure, or at the skeleton of the pop write. We have a wait, and then we have an exit branch where we signal on T and on T, and down here we signal T. And here, inside the mutex where T is held, we acquire S and we release S. So we only, observe deadlock freedom, the only thing we're interested in are operations that acquire locks, because we can only get a deadlock when we acquire locks. So starvation, something else, is a different thing. So something, if we never release a lock, for instance, if we or forget the signal here, then we have a different kind of mistake. It's not a deadlock. Okay, so a push left only contains a wait and a signal on the lock S. So if we analyze that, the lock set of S will be empty because we do not acquire any locks while we're holding S. Now in here, when we acquire the lock S, the lambda of this program point P contains the lock T because that's already being held, which means that we have T triangle S and the transitive closure. So, and this is all the triangle relations we will gather in these two procedures. And if we do the transitive closure, nothing interesting happens. So the transitive closure only contains this relation T is less than S. And since this is not a self-cycle, this is just, well, I mean, I should write it like this. This is not a self-cycle. S is not less than S, and T is not less than S. It's just this. We've shown that the program's deadlock-free. Big surprise. Okay. So initially, in the beginning of the lecture, I said something about atomic executions, and this is just like a very abstract way of saying, oh, we want to do this as one step. We could also... So I want to make an observation about atomic execution. So here we have one wait, one signal, and that's released here. And here we have one wait and one signal. Now consider changing wait and signal with an atomic. So we say atomic, opening parenthesis, this is replaced by a closing parenthesis. And in here, we exchange this and again with atomic, there we go. And this we replace by closing parenthesis. So we have two atomic blocks, and one is nested into the inside the other.
If one thing is atomic, then why do you need to nest atomic?
Ah, very good. Very astute observation. So the thing is that nested atomic blocks still describe a single atomic execution, which is interesting because that means that Since we can get more concurrency by adding finer granularity locking, by adding a new lock that only, by reducing the scope of the lock S that protects the adding of elements to this little span here and adding a new lock that only protects only the right-hand side of the queue where we remove elements. We added more locks into the program, and we get more fine, more concurrency. Now, if we simply say, turn these into atomic statements, then we have lost this information that we can actually do something more concurrent. So locks convey additional information over simple atomic blocks, which means that if we would add an atomic primitive or like atomic keyword into our language, then it's not easy to translate this into simple lock, into simple locks. And I think this is the basis of the next two lectures. So ideally, we would like to write atomic annotations around sequences of statement because it's convenient. It would take away all this burden of figuring out which parts we should lock at which granularity. Is there a deadlock? It would take all that away. And the idea of these mutexes is basically to implement atomic blocks with sequences of statements that are protected by atomic with semaphores, with locks. So, semantically, we could just use a single lock or semaphore to protect all the atomic blocks in the program. However, this is, as I've shown you with the doubly and list and the two blocks, this is not necessarily desirable because we can have much more concurrency if we're using several locks. So in the push left, pop right example with two locks, we might never actually block on each other if the queue always contains at least two elements. And then the programmer, like we've discussed last time, that can we not move the weight statement further down, and I've fixed the slide so that it's now one statement further down because the right sentinel was, I think it was the left sentinel. We're extracting the left sentinel, and the left sentinel is always the same, never changes, so we can do that outside the lock. But this shows that it's like not so easy to even place the locks and define the critical section because some variables there are only read, and then that never change, and we can always read them without being in a mutual exclusive region. And sometimes, you could even imagine that sometimes variables are never read. But if they're never read, that means I'm only the only one reading them, so then I don't need a lock here. So it's a bit trivial, but yeah, okay. I don't know, maybe I meant something else, something deeper. Who knows? Right, so statements in one atomic block might access variables in a different order than in another atomic block. And so if I'm now looking at the accesses and I'm trying to deduce locks from the set of possible accesses, and this thread first writes A and then writes B, and so I create a lock for A and a lock for B, and then here the thread first writes B and then A, so I create here a lock for B and a lock for A, trying to do it all automatically, then suddenly I created a deadlock situation because this might take A, this might take B, and then they're both stuck. So creating locks automatically from atomic statements is complicated or is not trivial. On the other hand, if I had this approach and I would be very careful about deadlocks, then and I created tons and tons of locks, then my performance might actually degrade because I need to do a lot of. So remember, these atomic blocks are basically implemented with the with lock-free and weight-free techniques. So these atomic operations are on the processor level, and these will usually block cache lines. And this is slow. This will prevent other CPUs from using at least that cache line, and if not, even blocking the bus for a certain time, depending on how old your processor is. And if you do this trick, if you compute your lock order and it has a cycle and you try to break the cycle by releasing a lock and then acquiring the lock in a different sequence just so that you don't create the cycle of dependencies, that could also be very expensive, because that means you own a lock, you release it just for the rare occasion that somebody else might acquire them in a different order. Okay. So creating locks automatically is non-trivial and thus not standard in programming languages. And I think this is probably the gist of it. You have to do it yourself. Concurrency across languages. So nowadays, there are usually libraries for these lock-free and wait-free operations. These are often platform-specific. So that means once we have these primitives, we can implement some wait-free algorithms, or rather, the library provides us with all the wait-free primitive operations that this platform has. And in higher-level languages like Java, they provide monitors and possibly these condition variables, maybe some other concepts. They simplify the programming a little bit, but they are not as expressive, but they usually never avoid deadlocks automatically or help you in placing locks. So it's just a different wrapping, and it looks prettier, but really you have the same problems. So synchronized looks very nice, looks like atomic, but it's not. Okay, so in C++, you can use barriers, what we had 4 weeks ago. We can have the lock-free, wait-free primitives. We can use semaphores, it's in pthreads. You can use mutexes built on semaphores. You can use monitors, which in the pthread library are just mutexes, and you set the reentrant attribute to true. Then in Java, you have semaphores by simulating them with mutexes. So we've seen that there's monitors, so you can implement mutexes, and if you have mutex, you don't have to protect a critical section. You can use them just for the sake of the condition variable. So you can use a condition variable without acquiring the monitor, I think. I should try that probably. And then you can use a simulated semaphore by simply like waiting and signaling, notifying on the condition variable. With two synchronized methods, yeah, that might be possible as well. Who knows? Oh yeah, because like if you implement notify or whatever, then oh. No, I was just thinking much simpler. You wrap a Boolean variable in a class, you have two operations that are synchronized. One that sets the variable to true, and if the variable is not true, it calls wait, and the other one sets the variable to zero or to false, and calling notify. Yes, I'm treating message passing, priority-based scheduling, and something else on the last slide, which contains all the things that I'm not covering. So that will be in 2 weeks' time. Yes, I mean, there's message passing. There's Erlang. I would use Erlang, really.
Yeah.
Erlang is probably the most widespread message passing language, which has a coolness factor because you can distribute and you can have failing nodes and everything and runtime code replacement. So, in summary, we can classify concurrent algorithms, primitives, let's say, in wait-free, lock-free, and locking. Next on the agenda is transactional algorithms. That will be next week and the next week thereafter. In 3 weeks' time, remember what I said on the 19th, there will be lecture. Either if I'm overrunning, I will be there, or Michael will be there with object orientation. So, first kind, wait-free, never blocks, always succeeds, never deadlocks, no starvation, excellent, should always use them, except when you have more to do than something really basic, because then it doesn't work. Then we have lock-free algorithms, they never block, they may fail, they never deadlock, but because they can fail, you have to retry, so they could starve. And what you can do there, your invariant still has to be kind of what you want to express has to fit into 8 bytes. If a pointer does the job, then that might be a cool thing. Locking algorithms can guard arbitrary code or resources, so file handles, for instance. You can use several locks to enable more fine-grained concurrency, as I've shown you. They may deadlock, which is bad. Semaphores are not reentrant. Monitors are. If you can't answer that in the exam, it's really your own fault. You know that, so that's good. That's why you're here. And people who are not here on the 19th know why. Don't deserve to know this. Use algorithms that fit best. So I'm done with the locks. Next week I'll be talking about transactional memory in software and in hardware. It'll be cool. Okay, thank you.